And good morning. Thank you very, very much for taking time from your schedule and spending time with me. And somebody's already trying to call, so evidently I need to answer that. If you will, though, turn your radio down before I pick it up. Good morning, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Morgan. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, ma'am?
Yes. I have a question. I'd like to see what you would recommend. My 81 aunt is in the hospital with pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
So any suggestions on what she could take?
Well, do you know if it's bacterial pneumonia or viral pneumonia?
I do not know.
Okay. Well, I know if she's in the hospital, they're going to probably put her on antibiotics if it's a bacterial-based pneumonia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have they told you what she's taking?
No. I know that she needed to get IV because she was dehydrated.
Oh, well, bless her heart. Goodness. Well, let me give you an idea. Everybody wants to have a very robust immune system. You don't want your immune system to be sluggish and not respond to an infection in a timely manner. So the one gland that has complete responsibility over the immune system of the lungs is going to be the thymus gland. So I'm not telling you to smuggle this into the hospital. I didn't say that. I'm not suggesting it. But if it were me, I would probably look at trying to give a person thymus extract, because what you want is you want her immune system rising to the occasion and definitely overcoming this infection she has.
Mm-hmm.
So it's called calf thymus extract. It comes from a young calf. Mm-hmm. And I think it's got to be one of the most excellent remedies of all time. Even last week, I read the story about the 9-year-old boy that was unconscious. He wasn't responsive to any stimuli. His lungs were filled with fluid, and the doctor gave the child thymus extract, and he made a complete recovery, and they fully expected him to die.
Mm-hmm.
So look into thymus extract, and I think you'll be very pleased. The article that I read earlier this morning, I don't have it in front of me, is they were saying a new treatment for viral pneumonia is proving very, very successful in other countries, and that's just the intravenous use of vitamin C. And I thought to myself, well, that's not toxic. That sounds like a pretty cheap remedy. But your thymus gland requires, let me think, if I had to choose one mineral, I would say zinc. If I had to choose one vitamin, well, one water-soluble vitamin would be vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
But vitamin A is the other element that it needs to function properly. So if she's a little bit run down and she's weak, you might just consider those and tell me what happens.
Okay. So is the thymus extract only if it's bacterial, or would it apply to viral also?
It would apply to fungal, viral, parasite. If somebody had cancer within the lungs, if the lungs were severely weakened, then yes, I would give thymus extract.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you want your immune system to do is, you want it to be like this, like a bunch of sentries and soldiers that are constantly seeking and searching out every nook and cranny so they can make sure that you don't have a foreign, you know, bug take up residence inside the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, I haven't done it probably much this year, but what I have done a lot of times in the past, if somebody walks in the office and they say, if I told you, Dr. Morgan, that my lungs were weak, what would you say? I'd say, well, I trust you, but let's have a look at them. And one of the simple things that I'll do is I'll just put a simple tape measure around their chest, and I'll say, blow out as much as you can, and then once I can, you know how I have a tape measure, or how you would also, you just kind of take up the slack. So let's just say that your aunt completely blows out all her air, and it measures exactly 36 inches. Then
mm-hmm.
I'll hold that mark, and I'll say, now breathe as deeply as you can. And I tell them, you expand your, just fill up your lungs with as much oxygen as you can, see what happens. And if it only expands about an inch or so, then I know that they're going to have a lung infection.
Mm-hmm.
Because if your lungs can't efficiently remove waste and debris, then it's just a matter of time before an infection takes them over. They're just too weak. But you know what I think is good?
What?
I think she needs to be able to expand her lungs at least 3 to 4 inches with a tape measure.
Okay.
A 2 is much better, but if I always see somebody hit below an inch and a half or an inch and a half or less rib cage expansion by inhaling deeply, I think the lungs are just too weak. I know that's a simple way of looking at it, but that's what I think.
Okay.
But please, let me know how it works out.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yes, thank you for your call. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, I came across a poem. I'm going to see if I can do it justice here. And it says the author is unknown. Okay, here goes. The best 6 doctors anywhere, and no one can deny it, are sunshine, water, rest, and air, exercise, and diet. These 6 will gladly you attend, if only you are willing. Your mind they'll ease, your will they'll mend, and charge you not a shilling. Don't you think that's good? The number here at the station is 903-586-5257. And I missed my opportunity, so if you'll wait just a moment and try to call. Okay, the phone line is clear now. So if you want to call and ask me a question or make a comment, please feel free to do so. Good morning and welcome to the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Dr. Morgan, I got a couple of questions and probably open up a can of worms, but whenever
Well, that's just your specialty, isn't it?
Yeah. Whenever a person has had a gallbladder operation, had it removed,
mm-hmm.
and the doctors want to put them on a low-fat diet,
yeah,
I want to know what your thoughts would be on that. And the other question is, what do you think about Coumadin for a blood thinner?
I didn't hear what you said. What for a blood thinner?
Coumadin.
Oh, okay. I got you. Let's go back to the gallbladder first.
Okay.
I think your gallbladder does a lot more than what people have been taught or have what they've been exposed to. They just haven't been taught about the gallbladder. But the gallbladder, it serves so many good functions. And so let's just say every night when you go to sleep, your liver and all the bile ducts in your liver, they're going to manufacture a good quart of bile overnight. And some of that bile is going to go directly into the gallbladder, just like your urinary bladder is a potential space to hold urine. But one of the roles of the gallbladder is to help concentrate bile so it can serve a very, very good purpose at helping keeping you very strong with tremendous vitality and great healing. So, number one, when bile is released from the gallbladder in a timely fashion and in response to eating foods that contain fat and other foods, it's probably the number one reason why we have what are called good peristaltic contractions. That's that wave-like muscular contractions of your intestines that allows you to move food through very, very efficiently. So without the gallbladder working properly, you can have it either way. You could either suffer from horrible diarrhea, or you could have stools that are watery and broken up in pieces and you can't stop it, which means you're probably losing some of your nutrients. But the other end of the spectrum would be constipation. So this is just my personal belief. But if somebody tells me they have horrible constipation, that's just one of the organ systems that I have to look at. But for a person that's had their gallbladder removed, even though the gallbladder is gone, their common bile duct, which is what transports bile from your liver to the intestines, that kind of becomes their new gallbladder in a roundabout way. The other thing that the gallbladder does a good job of is if it releases this potentially more potent, more concentrated bile, what that does is it makes sure that you can absorb your nutrients from the food that you're eating. So going back to the idea that we're not supposed to eat fat of any kind, you know what the main source of fat is on the island of Crete? It's called olive oil. And they tend to be some of the healthiest people on earth because they're consuming good oils. Bad oils, if you ask my opinion, are going to be things like corn oil, canola oil, soybean oil, safflower, sunflower seed oil. Those are called vegetable oils. And it kind of upsets me, but every time I walk by them in the store, you see the heart healthy symbol on them as if it produces heart health. Nothing could be further from the truth. As a matter of fact,
and they call it low fat.
Well, they call it low cholesterol.
Yeah.
Or they'll say it doesn't contain cholesterol. But back to the gallbladder. One of the main jobs of the gallbladder is keeping your body free from infections. So those concentrated bile acids and bile salts and bile, they do a remarkable job of making sure that you don't overgrow any type of toxic germs or microbes anywhere within your body. But between making sure that your bowels are moving properly, absorbing all the nutrients that you need from the food that you're eating, but they keep you free from toxins and infection. And so I'm going to suggest that the worst toxins that we ever encounter, those are fat-soluble toxins. And so your gallbladder plays a huge role in removing fat-soluble toxins. So those go out when you have a bowel movement. Water-soluble toxins, well, guess where they pass? They pass through the kidneys and the urine very easily. So the idea of a low-fat diet, you're asking for two or three things to take place. Number one, you're just going to suffer when it comes to absorption of nutrients. And this can, this is what could open up a can of worms, because you know what the top surgery is to make a hospital profit? It's usually gallbladder surgeries.
Yeah, it's only $21,000.
Really? Yeah, only $21,000. You just heard that number, huh? Anyway, I think it's a valuable organ, but what we should do is we just need to consider that the low-fat diet craze that everybody's been promoting, it hasn't done anything to improve the health of human beings. Now, if you eat healthy fats, those are almost always self-limiting. I mean, really, how much olive oil are you going to pour on your salad? Just enough to make it taste good, but you're probably not going to go hog wild and pour a gallon on top of it, are you?
No, or you could even melt a little bit of coconut oil and put it on there.
That's right. But those are all very, very healthy fats. So whether you tell me good high-quality butter or high-quality coconut oil, extra virgin olive oil, the type of oil that's found in raw nuts, the type of oil that's found in avocados, olives, all that's great stuff. But your body requires those just to absorb nutrients.
Could I incorporate a true statement about me?
Yeah. Well, if it's about you, it's true.
Well, the last 6 months, I've been eating the good fats and avoiding bread and sugar and mostly. And the more fat that I eat, it seems like, the slimmer I get.
Isn't that interesting? It's the exact opposite of what we're taught all day long, right?
Yes, sir.
If a person's on a low-fat diet, and I'm just going to oversimplify it, if you reduce fat in your diet, there's one thing that's going to increase every single time, and it's going to be called carbohydrates. But usually, they're going to be the carbohydrates that are basically sugar, or they convert easily into sugar. And so if you did the reverse of that, if you tried to lower carbohydrates, the only way to really do that successfully is by increasing fat, which is what you've done. And it's resulted into, or it's turned into weight loss, right?
Yes, sir. About 30 pounds.
Well, a high carbohydrate diet is probably the easiest way to make the gallbladder diseased, inflamed, or sick. I just think you're going to stress a person's gallbladder out. Of course, you know, there's plenty of medications out there that are just torturous on the gallbladder. Probably one of the common ones would be birth control pills, which I don't really think that you've taken birth control pills, have you?
No, sir.
But for women, that's a real big deal. So keeping your gallbladder is one of the greatest things that you can do. A lady asked me this, and actually the husband asked me, he said, because one thing I have them doing every morning in her situation is consuming a spoonful of freshly squeezed lemon juice and a spoonful of olive oil and just pour it in water. And you already know that oil and water don't mix, right?
Yes, sir.
But they said, what's that for? Now, this woman has, she's getting ready to have a liver transplant, but she wants to see if she can save herself before she gets to that point.
Good.
So I agree with you. I say, great. But they asked, she made a comment. She said, it happens every single time I do this. When I take the lemon juice and the olive oil each morning, I always go to the bathroom and produce a bowel movement. And she's happy about that.
Yeah.
And she said, what does the olive oil and lemon juice do? And I said, well, what I want to do is use the word solvent. as relates to lemon juice. You know how if you had dirty pants from working outside in the dirt and everything else, or cutting firewood or whatever you've been doing, you're going to use water and laundry detergent as a solvent to help separate the dirt from your, you know, blue jeans, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, lemon juice is going to be one of the most fabulous cleansing agents of all time. It's a solvent. It helps scrub and remove hardened debris from the liver. So in her case, I'm trying to gently scrub and clean hardened bile and gallstones and congealed bile and gunk from her liver so it can actually breathe and work properly. But the liver is a muscle just like your, well, not just like your skeletal muscles, but it's a muscle. A lot of people, when they eat liver and onions, they go, that's a weird texture.
Well, isn't that about the only organ that will regenerate?
Well, it's not the only one, but it's one of that and the spleen. Yeah, but you're right about that. If somebody's had a car wreck and 80% of the liver's been torn or cut off, it can completely grow back. I mean, isn't that just amazing?
It is.
But I have her consuming olive oil every morning because I want that liver to squeeze and contract, because I want it to push out all that yucky gunk that's in there so she can have a liver that works properly. And she's doing great so far. She's probably, I'm personally amazed that she's trying as hard as she is, because she's been in liver failure for basically 20 years.
Man.
And they've just let it go to the point to where she requires a liver transplant, but she's gonna take a risk here. She's going to see if she can turn this around. And, of course, you realize these things that I'm telling her, there's not one liver specialist that had ever spent more than, how about, does the number zero work? 0 seconds in teaching her how to restore health. 0 seconds. It's just, we're just watching and waiting. We're observing. We want you to take this drug when you're ammonia. Her ammonia levels were so high that she's basically hallucinating. Maybe I could say it that way. She's just not in her right mind. I mean, that's ammonia poisoning, because the liver has no ability to remove it, and that's one sick liver. But I asked her just the other day, I said, how much lactulose have you taken over the last 3+ weeks, and maybe a little over 3 weeks. It could be closer to 4 at this point. She hasn't taken any. I said, doesn't that tell you, young lady, that your liver's in better working order? And she tells me she feels better. She told me specifically that she had so much energy after the B12 injection. Do you think that's a fluke, that she had lots of energy and she felt really good after a B12 injection? I don't think so.
Oh, I know. I've watched people give it to horses, and it sure perks them up.
Amen. I just wish Tractor Supply still had B12 that patients could go, I mean, human beings could go in and get it for their horses. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
So humans could get it for their horses. But yes, you want to take good care of the gallbladder, and so eating these good fats has resulted in weight loss. So way to go, buddy. Number two, did I answer that enough, or do you want more information?
Oh, that's enough. It wasn't me that had the surgery.
Right. But you're thinking about somebody else you love, right?
That's right. And also, give us an entry on the Chemodyne. I worry about people that take that stuff and just touch their skin, and all of a sudden it...
Well, I mean, if I can,
pitiful.
Let me stay on the same topic. You know how I just was mentioning that olive oil and lemon juice, it helps the liver contract more efficiently?
Yes, sir.
I think what probably surprises people is how sluggish the liver and gallbladder can become over 60 years on Earth. And sometimes the liver is just the most overworked organ in the body, because it's a detoxifier, it's a great filter, it's trying to remove impurities from your bloodstream. It probably does more than we realize to keep women's hormones in balance. So, you know, we could take off on that topic and say, if a woman has a hormone issue, it's either one or the other. Either she has too little to function properly, or she has too much. And so if it's too much, then that probably leads us into two more possibilities. Either the liver is not doing its job to keep hormones in balance, which that's what the liver does. I've seen plenty of women that had hormonal problems, and that's really the only thing that we had to do was just improve the liver function so she didn't have horrible hot flashes, or PMS, if I can say it that way.
So the liver and the gallbladder works together, so if you give it
Yeah, they're paired organs. They work together as a team, or they're supposed to anyway.
If you give the liver the good fat, then the gallbladder's going to get some good stuff from it.
Yeah, but if we switch that around and say I'm only going to eat French fries and onion rings that have been fried in corn oil, then you're asking to make the gallbladder work a lot harder than what it should, and the liver also. Well, this may go without saying, but I think if I had to choose one substance that can pretty much shut down almost any organ or any system in the body, it had to be just lots of refined sugar. There's just no way around it.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, I don't even hear physicians even mention sugar. What I've heard on the radio is, we've really done a great job with chemotherapy here at, whatever the hospital system is in Tyler. That now patients can eat a Big Mac, eat their French fries, and drink a Coke and a milkshake and a fried apple pie while they're taking it. As if that's a reason to brag. But listen, everybody else has listened to me, has heard those ads also on the radio. It's just maddening. Back to the liver. Your liver, one of the charges of the liver, I'm not trying to say it's a panacea, but one of the other great things your liver does is it continually monitors the thickness or the thinness of the blood. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And obviously, if your blood flows, actually, let me back up slightly. There is a common blood test that's very cheap, and probably every physician does them every day, or every nurse practitioner or physician's assistant. They probably order these all day long. In common lingo, they just call it a CBC, like a complete blood count or a cell blood count. Very cheap, very inexpensive test. All the hospitals do them, and they do them very accurately. But there's one marker on there called hematocrit. And that the one called hematocrit, I can tell you right now, when the number is at 42, that's a good number. But what if that number were at 48? It's still in the normal range, but the latest study that I read said that if the number goes from 42, which is considered normal blood thickness, to 48, you have double the risk of heart attacks because your blood's becoming increasingly thicker. You tell me, would you rather turn on your water hose when it's warm outside, or would you rather leave it attached when it's like 20 below zero? Well, nothing's going to come out of the water hose when it's frozen, is it?
No, sir, that happened to me this
What happened to you?
It froze up. I was trying to keep my peach trees from getting frostbite, and I would sprinkle them, in the morning before daylight when it frosted. Well, it froze up, and I had to wait.
Oh, boy. How many peach trees do you have?
Six.
Oh, good. I bet those are fabulous, aren't they?
No, they're not doing too good. I'm going to buy more and plant some more. I don't want to.
Well, see, though, but you're not giving up and throwing in the towel. You're going to keep trying, aren't you?
I sure am.
Well, back to the liver. One of the jobs or the roles of the liver is making sure that your blood is not too thick or not too thin. So let me give you a different take on this. Back in the 1950s, it was just nearly impossible for a physician to find a person that had a fatty liver, or if you want to call it sclerosis of the liver or cirrhosis of the liver, whatever they want to call it. It just means the liver is clogged up with a whole bunch of fat. But it was nearly impossible for them to find someone that had a fatty liver unless they were an alcoholic.
Yes.
And so you may have heard that the molecule found in alcoholic beverages called alcohol, it's not broken down like protein is. It's not really broken down like fat. But if anything, your body probably treats alcohol in a more similar fashion when it breaks it down and burns it off like it does sugar or carbohydrates. So I'm just saying there's a similarity. I know they're different. I'm not trying to say honey and alcohol are the same thing, but your body kind of treats alcohol as such. But today, you can just about find everybody that you meet in Walmart's got a fatty liver, especially if they're wheelchair-bound or if they're overweight. I mean, this ain't rocket science, but it's because we have over-consumed carbohydrates. And so the liver can become so infiltrated with so much fat that, let me ask you this. Do you have grandkids?
Yes, sir.
Now, if you hold one grandkid in your arms, are you pretty happy?
Yes, sir.
Well, what if you have 10 of them all trying to give you a bear hug? You might say, kids, get off of me. I can't breathe. You're smothering me. And this is only an analogy I'm making, but if you have so much fat in your liver, it's going to push against the liver cells so they can't breathe. They can't work properly. Guess what happens to the liver when you start to dissolve all that fat? It starts to work properly. I had a gentleman here recently. His triglycerides went from 1,500, and I'm saying that number correctly, 1,500 for years, down to 199 in 1 month. And the only thing that I used that I'm convinced that took care of that was an herb called Gymnema. Now, he has a fatty liver, but I don't know that I'm very successful at convincing him to stop eating so much food. But your liver, how can it keep the blood properly thin if it's not working properly? So that would be one of the things that I would point toward. If we're going to have the blood or the liver do its job by keeping the blood at the right consistency, it's got to be healthy. So I would say giving up sugar would be one of the greatest things that a person could do to try to improve their liver health. At the same time, if they start eating things like kale and Brussels sprouts and cabbage and coleslaw and broccoli and sweet potatoes and avocados, I'd say we're in business. Anyway, back to the Coumadin. Is this a real live person that's taking Coumadin, or the doctor's recommended Coumadin?
Yes.
Can you give me a little bit more information, just vague details?
It's a lady. She's 90 that my wife helps take care of.
Okay. Well, that's a tough one, because under normal circumstances, and let me just kind of create a scenario, and you tell me if it's accurate or not. Your liver, if you're very active all day long, it's going to filter about 640 gallons of blood. This is just average, okay? So if this lady who's 90, and I realize I'm saying 90 and all this information, you have to tell me what the... See, my mother's close to 90, but she's very active. But if you're very active, your liver can filter about 640 gallons of blood a day. But what happens if you're not active? Do you think that number goes down? Yes.
Yes,
sir. Yeah, exactly, because the less you move, this is when your blood starts to become tired and sluggish and maybe even a bit lazy. I'm just referring to the blood. I'm not saying she's lazy. And so what may happen is her liver may only filter about 150 gallons of blood just because blood is moving so slow.
Yeah, she's not too active. She can walk and... But, you know, not very active. Don't get enough exercise.
Exactly. So some of the things that I think of is if I can reduce carbohydrates and sugar, increase vegetable intake, those are things that are good for the liver. I think when someone's 90, dandelion tea is probably going to be one of the most gentle, easy remedies of all time. But you've already said the other ones. Didn't you say melting a little bit of coconut oil?
Yes, sir.
Didn't we talk about olive oil and avocados? But we want to find out what's the potential for her body repairing. But you don't want her blood to be so overly thin that if you just sneeze on her forearm, she has bloody purple marks.
Uh-huh.
It just doesn't take much to damage it, does it?
And there's a friend of mine. I think he's in his early 60s, and he's on it.
Oh, I've seen people on it in their 30s before. It just blows my mind.
Said he can't get off of it.
Well, that's because they haven't done their job in explaining to the patient more aggressively. But if they expound upon the topic more adequately on this is how you do it, then you won't need the blood thinners. But historically, you want to try to improve the liver, and you do that by feeding it. And see, the liver, I've talked to my liver many times, and it says the same thing. Okay, I'll do what you want, Roy, but you're going to have to feed me. And I go, okay, what do you want? It usually says something like avocados or sweet potatoes or broccoli.
Yeah.
So your liver can do almost anything, but this lady you're referring to or telling me about, is she real energetic or is she probably, does she seem to be kind of tired all the time?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, all we can do is the best we can. I just know that one of the most gentle remedies to improve the liver is going to be dandelion.
Okay. Well, when she's over here, which is a couple of days a week, then we're going to give her dandelion tea.
Yeah. Well, let me know what happens, all right?
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for your phone call.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye. I think I figured out that he falls in love with almost everybody that he meets, and he just naturally wants to serve them and help them and bless them. Well, I mean, what are we here for if we're not supposed to help each other? I'm going to read just a brief letter to you. This is not going to take very long, but I want you just to listen to these words carefully. I find it very, very interesting. Okay. This letter comes from the Well-Being Journal, but it's from, and I quote, "The Brain's Way of Healing, : Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity" by Norman Doidge, M.D. This comes from Viking Books, 2015. After reading this, I think I may get on Amazon and see what that book costs. Roy just may have to buy that. And the reason why I'm into information like this is, why wouldn't you want to heal from a neurological disease or an injury? Very, very fascinating. Well, what I want you to do is I want you to think about yourself as I read this. And I want you to think about your grandparents. I want you to think about your children and your parents. And if you're a parent, I want you to think about your future here. So, here goes. And this is just one example. Norman Doidge, M.D., received the following letter from John Pepper, a man who had Parkinson's disease. Doidge included the letter, written in 2008, in a chapter on Parkinson's in his new book, The Brain's Way of Healing. If you all aren't familiar with a disease called Parkinson's disease, every physician that I know of expects it to get radically worse over time. So just kind of keep that in mind. And yes, they excel at naming the disease Parkinson's disease. They excel at that. But does that do anything to change the outcome just because they use their energy diagnosing it? Anyway, here's the letter. "I live in South Africa and have had Parkinson's disease since 1968. I do a lot of exercise, and I have learned to use my conscious brain to control the movements." You may not notice, but Parkinson's patients, they don't walk so well, and they have tremors and shakes. Okay. "I wrote a book about my experience, but it has been rejected by the medical profession without looking into my case, because I no longer look like a Parkinson's disease sufferer." Interesting. Next sentence. "I no longer take Parkinson's disease medication, although I still have most of the symptoms. I walk 15 miles per week in 3 sessions of 5 miles each. The glial-derived neurotrophic factor produced in the brain appears to have restored the damaged cells. However, this does not cure the cause of Parkinson's. And listen to this, and if I stop exercising, I go backward. I'm sure that I can help many newly diagnosed patients if I can encourage them to do serious regular exercise. Please let me know your thoughts on this matter. Sincerely, John Pepper." I'm telling you, folks, there is a lot to that letter. Either you're going to tell me you believe it or you don't. But this is since 1968, so this is 40 years. Dr. Doidge continues, and I'm going to quote him. "My thought was that, as far-fetched as it might seem, Pepper, by battling aspects of Parkinson's disease with a low-tech approach of walking, might indeed be triggering neuroplastic change in his brain. That means healing. The glial-derived neurotrophic factor, sometimes it's called GDNF, that he referred to, is a brain growth factor. It functions like a growth-promoting fertilizer in the brain." Maybe you want to look that up, folks. It's called glial-derived neurotrophic factor. "It functions like a growth-promoting fertilizer in the brain." I like that image. We're just not going to use synthetic fertilizers, are we, folks? Okay. Glial-derived neurotrophic factor is made by glial cells, one of the major types of cells in the brain. We know that glial cells are constantly communicating with one another, interacting with neurons and modifying their electrical signals. They also are neuroprotective of neurons, helping them to wire and to rewire the brain. Frank Collins and his colleagues, Frank Collins, a physician, and his colleagues discovered glial-derived neurotrophic factor in 1993. And they found that it contributes to plastic change in the brain by promoting the development and the survival of dopamine-producing neurons. And these are the cells that die off in Parkinson's. I know y'all don't know this, but that was one of my research papers back in the 80s, was kind of a dissertation concerning Parkinson's disease. Oh, I can assure you, I did not have this information at the time. Had I had this information, I would have included this, and it probably would have made me look a little bit smarter to my instructor. I'm just joking. Okay, here we go. Back to the letter. And I'm quoting Dr. Deutsch. As long as Pepper kept up his walking, he could reverse the main movement symptoms of Parkinson's. The changes had so helped him that he was no longer suffering from the main disabilities of Parkinson's disease, and he was living a full life. Now I'm going back to John Pepper's letter. And if I stop exercising, I go backward. Folks, I can't make this stuff up. John Pepper later wrote to Deutsch again, and I quote, "I will be ashamed to die with all this information and not be able to do something for Parkinson's patients." Dr. Deutsch traveled to South Africa to meet with Pepper, and he writes about Pepper's life and his findings with regard to Parkinson's. And he included this in a 76-page chapter in his new book called The Brain's Way of Healing. So there's a chapter for you, 76 pages long. Good morning and welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great.
Excellent. How can I help?
Well, my husband is in about 2 weeks fixing to go through double knee replacement surgery. And I'm concerned about him because he has myasthenia gravis. And he's very overweight, and I just was going to see if you had some suggestions for helping him for the next 2 weeks to kind of prepare for it.
Does it concern you if the doctors tell him to come off all nutritional supplements before the surgery?
No.
It concerns me greatly because I think it's going to leave him vulnerable and exposed to major problems. Now, myasthenia gravis is going to be it's an autoimmune disease where your immune system actively attacks a gland called the thymus gland.
Mm-hmm.
The thymus gland, to a large degree, has almost everything to do with how much vitality and energy that your husband has. It's been shown that when the thymus is working properly, you have much stronger muscular contractions, you have better balance, you have healing energy and vitality. So if you see a young person climb up a pole with ease and swing from the bars and like a kid playing, they probably have a pretty strong thymus gland. But if the thymus weakens, the word they used to use is they would say it involutes, meaning it shrinks or atrophies. I don't think people use the word involution anymore. Maybe evolution, just not involution. But if he has Parkinson's disease, myasthenia gravis, then that would be my main concern. Is I want things to go really, really well for him, but what you're going to discover and find is that he probably has very, very severe vitamin B12 deficiencies. And that's probably the main thing that the anesthesia is going to do for him. It's going to destroy all his B12. Personally, I think the doctors would be nuts not to give him B12 injections before and after the surgery. Because there was a very famous, I do not remember the name of the Japanese POW camp in World War II. Hashimoto's. I just made that up, okay? But what mm-hmm. happened was a lot of the U.S. airmen and the British airmen that were captives of this POW camp, there was a very unusually high occurrence of a condition called myasthenia gravis. And they were so physically weak that they couldn't lift their arms or they couldn't move. And back in the 1940s, there was only one remedy that they discovered that would actually reverse the effects of myasthenia gravis. And I hope you're sitting down when I tell you this, because most people want to throw up as soon as I tell you what the remedy was. The only thing they found to cure them was eating 16 ounces of liver a day. And liver has the highest natural concentration of B12. Now, it used to be that back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, people probably ate liver once a week, so they got a generous amount of B12. But if he has myasthenia gravis, and he's going to have double knee replacement,
yes,
I'm a little bit scared, because if his B12 levels are low, this is the number one predictor to how well he's going to do.
They have been high. Matter of fact, he's... His B12 level has been high because his doctor has had him on extra amount of it.
What do you mean they had him on extra amount of it?
Well, through vitamins.
You mean through supplementation?
Yes.
Well, let me tell you what that really means, because they didn't explain it to you. Let's just say that you do a blood test and you say anything above the number 1,000 is going to be high. And that's what his has been, right? So when they do a blood test on B12, it comes back high, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That means he's not able to split those protein bonds apart and use it. So he's got it, he just can't use it. Thus, giving intramuscular injections. What are the side effects of overdosing on B12? Oh, wait a second, there are none. Yeah, it's coming back to me now. There are none, because it's a water-soluble vitamin. I don't think I've ever heard of a case where B12, with rare exception. So if his blood tests come back high, this means it's building up in his body because he can't utilize it. The liver is the organ that stores and houses B12. But that's really what that means. So I've had many, many patients over the years explain to me they don't need B12 because it's really high. And I explain to them that that's not necessarily so. And so does he have too much energy right now?
No.
Okay. It's really black and white. If he were to get a B12 injection, B12 injections are the one way that we can bypass the weakness in the body, which is what he has. I'm not trying to label him. I'm just telling you straight up what's going on. And so if he took a B12 injection and you asked him, "Sweetheart, how do you feel now?" He goes, "Oh, my goodness, it's like somebody flipped on the switch. It's like I have energy all of a sudden." So
he gets an IVIG every 2 weeks.
Well, what I want to do is I want to turn off his autoimmune reactions toward the... See, the thymus is the key to autoimmune reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And so thus, using what's called thymus PMGs, it's called a protomorphogen glandular. It's a genius invention by Dr. Royal Lee from the 1920s. But when you take these thymus protomorphogens, it completely turns off the autoimmune reactions. That's called healing and repair. That's what I want for your husband.
Oh,
and instead of his whole world revolving around, I have to go for a 4-hour infusion here, I have to go to another doctor's visit. I mean, mm-hmm. what do the doctors do for him to reverse his disease when he goes?
Well, I guess basically nothing.
Well, I mean, I'm just asking your opinion, because I'm open to them doing a lot of things that are good for him.
It's, you know, they're trying to help him live with it, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right, so they're just trying to make him peaceful with the use of drugs and other therapies to kind of suppress symptoms, right?
Right.
So this is going to be a pretty big deal on everybody having a double knee replacement, right?
Yes.
Well, if your doctor will give you B12 injections, I'd do one every day until the surgery.
Okay.
And I have not uncovered any research that says that B12 is toxic. If somebody has a different idea, I'd like to know what that is. But unfortunately, there's been a tremendous shift over the last 20 years. B12 is treated almost as if it's a toxic poison, whereas drugs like Lipitor and statins are not.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the man told me this week? He investigates. He's the one that investigates people that die. And so every time he says the vast majority of all people that he does these death investigations on, they're on an average of 30 to 35 medications. He knows because he has to write each one of them down. And quite often they have one doctor that's prescribing one drug, and the person's going to a different doctor and getting different ones, and the pharmacist may not necessarily catch that or whatever. But I thought to myself, 35 medications? Are you kidding me? That's like the world record. How could somebody take that many drugs? But he says they're almost always between 50 and 60 years of age, and they just mysteriously die, which the number one cause of death in the U.S. currently is heart disease. Number two is cancer. But number three is going to be drug reactions or mistakes related to drugs or surgery. Anyway, but please tell me, what is the very best thing I can do for you today?
Well, just any information you can give me on helping him with the myasthenia. Do you think...
Well, the thymus gland... Well, the other thing that I thought of is there's a sulfur-based polypeptide vitamin called glutathione. And I think it's been shown over and over again that glutathione is almost always very, very low when it comes to myasthenia gravis. So supplementing his body with glutathione may prove to be extremely beneficial. But between vitamin B12 and thymus extract and glutathione and vitamin D3 and staying away from sugar, and you're trying to build up an energy reserve because he's going to go through a pretty big deal. The reason I probably spend so much time on B12 is it's literally the number one predictor on how well somebody's going to do following surgery. And so they can determine, but his B12 levels are high, which means his body has lost its ability to split and absorb and utilize B12. I know I'm the only one that has that opinion, but every time somebody comes to me with high B12 and they get a B12 shot and they go, I cannot even tell you how wonderful I feel right now. And I'm going, well, are you open to the possibility that maybe your body's having a hard time processing it? And they say yes. So that's just one idea right there. But I don't think there's any way you could overdose him. I'm not worried about that at all. And if he wants to eat calf liver every day, what can I do to stop him? He's probably in the background right now licking his lips thinking, finally, I get permission to eat liver and onions. Love
he
it.
Does. He loves it.
Well, good. Give him all he wants.
Okay.
You know what I think is maddening, though? Sometimes before a surgery, a physician will even if it's not a surgery, they will go ballistic if somebody's taking supplements. They just think it's like Satan incarnate almost. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, this is just so misplaced. Nutrients are the very thing that he needs to rebuild his body after having this, knee replacement.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the number one predictor is on how rapidly knees are going to wear out? It's vitamin D levels.
Hmm.
So how much time does he spend out in the sunshine?
Quite a bit.
Don't stop.
Okay.
The number one food that I have found over and over again that probably blocks absorption of vitamin D is probably going to be wheat and then sugar, number one, and number two. But when someone's overweight, their fat cells literally soak up all the vitamin D, and they don't leave any remaining for the other tissues of the body.
Now, is it calcium that helps with the absorption of vitamin D?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
Really, all you need is, even if you take a fat soluble, vitamin D is a fat soluble vitamin in some ways. It may kind of act more like a hormone than it does a vitamin, but one of the things that vitamin D does, it makes sure that your DNA or your cells or genes or chromosomes play out very, very good commands so your body can have good healing that takes place. But if there's a lack of vitamin D, oh my word, this is where you're going to see the most autoimmune disease, the most cancer. I'm not trying to be negative, I promise you I'm not, but I'm just thinking, what happens to the body when we're not getting enough sufficient vitamin D to keep all the cells and tissues in great working order? So, for example, if somebody was prone to being overweight or diabetes, there's the vitamin D deficiency right there. I can tell you historically the two most common symptoms of all time when a human being is low in vitamin D3, it's going to be fatigue that just never completely resolves itself or clears up. It's going to be pain number two that doesn't go away. So there you go. You've got fatigue.
He's got both of those.
Well, and that's what you'd see. So if we give him vitamin D right now and plenty of it, he's going to actually do better. But do you hear what the guy said earlier, that the more fat that he's eaten, the less he weighs? I don't know if you heard that gentleman say that earlier before you called.
I did not.
But it's really as true as it can be, because fats, your immune system doesn't react to fats. It only reacts to protein when it comes to autoimmunity. So if there's going to be an allergy, it's going to be to the protein fraction. That's one of the reasons why I like higher fat diets with lower carbohydrates when you're trying to get a person to heal and reverse the disease trend.
And what foods would you recommend that are high in D3?
Well, there really aren't any foods. I mean, you could say cod liver oil has D3. That would be true. If somebody has chickens that run around out in the pasture or the field and they get sunshine, their yolks could have a little bit of vitamin D3. If cows are grazing where there's great grass, they're going to have a little D3. But historically, cod liver oil is what's been used. But in his situation, we probably just need to go ahead and get some vitamin D3. It's called vitamin D3, or sometimes it's called...
He does take that.
Well, but at his level, he's probably going to require a minimum of 10,000 units a day if we're going to budge his levels or improve him.
Okay.
So you can just kind of look at the dose he's taking, but it's probably going to take closer to that. But what you want is, if he loses weight, if his immune system stops attacking himself, that's pretty good. You know where I get that information about vitamin D and... knee arthritis or knee or the cartilage wearing out? That comes from the famous Framingham study. They looked at every possible factor and they said the greatest predictor of someone that's going to develop severe arthritis of the knees is going to be vitamin D levels. Because people that have plenty of vitamin D, they rarely develop knee arthritis. There's a lot of factors, I know.
Okay.
So if he likes to eat wheat, I might actually try for 2 weeks prior to the surgery not eating any wheat. I realize this may be kind of a shock, but I wouldn't have a drop of sugar. I probably wouldn't even eat any fruit of any kind or grains. Of course, he'll probably... You know what the guy told me on the phone yesterday? I think it's a little bit comical, but he's already very physically fit. But he was saying... he called with a question. He said, when can I start eating sugar again? But he has an issue that we're trying to resolve. So I said, why don't you try no sugar? And let's just say we're 10 days out. And I said, well, before I answer that question, what's happened? He says, well, I feel really good. And he says, but I've only dropped about 8 or 9 pounds. To myself, all righty. If a lean person drops 8 or 9 pounds in about 10 days, I'm going, well, what does that tell you? So, I mean, he can literally improve himself greatly over the next 2 weeks to where the surgery goes a lot easier and better.
All right. Thank you for your help.
So meat and vegetables, to answer your question.
Okay.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. If you have a question and you want to join me on the radio, please feel free to call. The number is 903-586-5257. That's 903-586-5257. I kind of want the guy to call and talk about the Weimar Republic and his mother again. Good morning. Welcome to the program. How are you? Hello?
How are you this fine morning?
I'm good.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Listen, I'm calling. I run into a young lady that needs some help.
I can barely hear you, by the way.
Oh, really? Let me try another phone. Hold on.
You betcha.
Is this better?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very, very much.
Oh, okay. I run into a young lady that I really want to do whatever I can to help her within my ability.
Mm-hmm.
This one I'm at a loss for sure. She's not completely bedridden, but she lays down a lot, and she's wheelchair-bound otherwise. She has developed bed sores. I went and purchased some antibiotics and some sterile gauze, but I don't know if that's really a good answer for her.
Does she have any type of a medical diagnosis like diabetes or anything?
I don't think she has diabetes.
Well,
a young lady,
what would she say is her main issue?
I'm not sure if she has cancer or not.
Well, how old is she?
She's approximately, I would say, maybe 30.
Well, when you visit with her, has she told you when was the last time that she felt really good? When was she very, very healthy?
It's been quite a few years. I know her white blood count is not good.
Well, she's just 30. Bless her heart.
I think she's in her 30s, early 30s.
Okay.
Yes. I haven't known her very long.
Well, you know what? I know I'm an oversimplifier, but it probably helps me keep everything organized in my brain. But I always think within the person's immune system.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think we talk about this at all, except for somebody like me, because I love talking about this stuff. But a lot of times if a person gets sick, you know, they'll just say, oh, it's a virus, or it's your genetics, or nothing you can do about it, just take antibiotics. And I think
true.
We are not even doing our job at explaining to people how to take care of themselves. But I still go back, if you have a person that has a condition beyond 7 days, that means the thymus and the spleen aren't even working right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to help her, you might go to her and sit beside her bed and just read to her about the thymus gland and read her stories and read about the spleen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things, I mean, it's just, there's two basic issues with the immune system. Either it's under-functioning, and that would be chronic infections and bed sores, too weak to get out of bed. White blood cell counts low. That's just what you told me. The other extreme would be autoimmune reaction. It's overreacting to everything. So you want to identify which one is it. In her case, it's underfunctioning.
Okay.
So if it's underfunctioning, why don't we start feeding the body? And you can feed the body things like spleen extracts and thymus extracts. Maybe that's why vitamin C works so well, is because it helps the body heal more rapidly. I remember when people have scurvy, they just don't heal. But
scurvy.
Yes, and I've seen so many conditions just heal very easily. But I would say the number one substance that's going to completely prevent her body from healing is going to be sugar.
Okay.
I see it over and over. I sound like a broken record talking to myself right now. If they're eating sugar, it's because someone has not adequately explained to them. But what you want is you want her to look you in the eye, even if she's very weak, and say, I cannot go on any longer like this.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to live this way the rest of my life. Things are not looking good for me if I continue on this course. I'm sick of it. I've had up to here. My back is against the wall. What am I going to do to help myself? And you're going to lovingly say, let's use food to heal your body. So,
yeah.
I mean, you realize how extremely intelligent I am to ask the following question. When someone heals, I say, tell me again, how'd you do that? It's almost comical every time. They say, I decide I was only going to eat real food that God's made. And I'm going, oh, interesting, let me write that down. I've never heard of that before. That's good. And then number two, I didn't consume a drop of sugar.
Okay.
But you can do this. It's so easy to do this. So easy. Very easy. But right now, we have to strike while the iron's hot, because she has lost so much of her vitality and her energy. She's probably completely exhausted. You know what would happen if she had energy? She would be like you. She'd be like the little Energizer Bunny, constantly going and checking on people, going to church, getting out doing normal stuff, but doing work all day long. That's what people do when they feel good. They do stuff.
That's true. Very true.
Well, I'm rooting for her, so... If I had more time, we would flesh this out a little bit more, but I almost wish we could wheel her out into the sunshine today.
Yes, that would be nice. Okay, so thymus extract.
And spleen extract.
And spleen.
Yes,
okay.
Ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and
yes.
You have a blessed rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate you. Well, unfortunately, we're all out of time. I'll look forward to being with you next week. Thank you.